In any case, the equations for such gravitational theory contain within themselves a description of the motions of a planetary system, of a double star, of tides, and of many other things. Making use of such equations, we can even set up a pictorial simulation and have a planet circling a star, or two stars circling each other on a two-dimensional screen, or set up more complicated systems in a three-dimensional holograph. Such simplified simulations make it far easier to grasp a phenomenon than it would be if we had to study the phenomenon itself. In fact, without the gravitational equations, our knowledge of planetary motions and of celestial mechanics generally would be sparse indeed. Now, as you wish to know more and more about any phenomenon, or as a phenomenon becomes more complex, you need more and more elaborate equations, more and more detailed programming, and you end with a computerized simulation that is harder and harder to grasp. "Can't you form a simulation of the simulation?" asked Tummin. "You would go down another degree." "In that case, you would have to eliminate some characteristic of the phenomenon which you want to include, and your simulation becomes useless." The LPS, that is, the least possible simulation, gains in complexity faster than the object being simulated does, and eventually the simulation catches up with the phenomenon. Thus it was established thousands of years ago that the universe as a whole, in its full complexity, cannot be represented by any simulation smaller than itself. In other words, you can't get any picture of the universe as a whole except by studying the entire universe. It has been shown also that if one attempts to substitute simulations of a small part of the universe, then another small part, then another small part, and so on, intending to put them all together to form a total picture of the universe, one would find that there are an infinite number of such part simulations. It would therefore take an infinite time to understand the universe in full, and that is just another way of saying that it is impossible to gain all the knowledge there is. "I understand you so far," said Doris, sounding a little surprised. "Well then, we know that some comparatively simple things are easy to simulate, and as things grow more and more complex, they become harder to simulate, until finally they become impossible to simulate. But at what level of complexity does simulation cease to be possible? Well, what I have shown, making use of a mathematical technique first invented in this past century, and barely usable, even if one employs a large and very fast computer, our galactic society falls short of that mark. It can be represented by a simulation simpler than itself. And I went on to show that this would result in the ability to predict future events in a statistical fashion. That is, by stating the probability for alternate sets of events, rather than flatly predicting that one set will take place." "In that case," said Hummin, "since you can profitably simulate galactic society, it's only a matter of doing so. Why is it impractical?" "All I have proved is that it will not take an infinite time to understand galactic society. But if it takes a billion years, it will still be impractical. That will be essentially the same as infinite time to us." "Is that how long it would take, a billion years?" "I haven't been able to work out how long it would take, but I strongly suspect that it will take at least a billion years, which is why I suggested that number." "But you don't really know." "I've been trying to work it out." "Without success?" "Without success." "The university library does not help?" Hummin cast a look at Doris as he asked the question. Selden shook his head slowly. "Not at all."
"Doris can't help?"
Doris sighed.
"I know nothing about the subject, Cheddar. I can only suggest ways of looking. If Harry looks and doesn't find, I am helpless."
Hummin rose to his feet.
In that case, there is no great use in staying here at the university, and I must think of somewhere else to place you.
Selden reached out and touched his sleeve. Still, I have an idea.
Hummond stared at him with a faint narrowing of eyes that might have belied surprise or suspicion.
When did you get the idea? Just now?
No, it's been buzzing in my head for a few days before I went upperside. That little experience eclipsed it for a while. But asking about the library reminded me of it.
Hummond seated himself again.
Tell me your idea, if it's not something that's totally marinated in mathematics.
No mathematics at all. It's just that reading history in the library reminded me that galactic society was less complicated in the past. 12,000 years ago, when the Empire was on the way to being established, the galaxy contained only about 10 million inhabited worlds. 20,000 years ago, the pre-imperial kingdoms included only about 10,000 worlds altogether. Still deeper in the past, who knows how society shrinks down? Perhaps even to a single world, as in the legends you yourself once mentioned, Hummond.
Hummond said, "And you think you might be able to work out psychohistory if you dealt with a much simpler galactic society?"
"Yes. It seems to me that I might be able to do so."
"Then, too," said Doris with sudden enthusiasm, "suppose you work out psychohistory for a smaller society of the past, and suppose you can make predictions from a study of the pre-imperial situation as to what might happen 1,000 years after the formation of the empire. You could then check the actual situation at that time and see how near the mark you were."
Hummond said coldly, "Considering that you would know in advance the situation of the year 1000 of the galactic era, it would scarcely be a fair test. You would be unconsciously swayed by your prior knowledge, and you would be bound to choose values for your equation in such a way as to give you what you would know to be the solution."
"I don't think so," said Doris. "We don't know the situation in 1000 GE very well, and we would have to dig. After all, that was 11 millennia ago.
Selden's face turned into a picture of dismay. "What do you mean we don't know the situation in 1000 GE very well? There were computers then, weren't there, Doris?"
"Of course."
"And memory storage units, and recordings of ear and eye? We should have all the records of 1000 GE as we have of the present year of 12,020 GE.
"In theory, yes. But in actual practice, well, you know, Harry, it's what you keep saying. It's possible to have full records of 1000 GE, but it's not practical to expect to have it."
"Yes, but what I keep saying, Doris, refers to mathematical demonstrations. I don't see the applications to historical records."
Doris said defensively, "Records don't last forever, Harry. Memory banks can be destroyed or defaced as a result of conflict, or can simply deteriorate with time. Any memory bit, any record that is not referred to for a long time, eventually drowns in accumulated noise. They say that fully 1/3 of the records in the Imperial Library are simply gibberish. But, of course, custom will not allow those records to be removed. Other libraries are less tradition-bound. In the Streeling University Library, we discard worthless items every 10 years. Naturally, records frequently referred to and frequently duplicated on various worlds and in various libraries, governmental and private, remain clear enough for thousands of years so that many of the essential points of galactic history remain known, even if they took place in pre-imperial times. However, the farther back you go, the less there is preserved."
"I can't believe that," said Selden. "I should think that new copies would be made of any record in danger of withering, How could you let knowledge disappear?
Undesired knowledge is useless knowledge, said Doris. Can you imagine all the time, effort, and energy expended in a continual refurbishing of unused data? And that wastage would grow steadily more extreme with time.
Surely you would have to allow for the fact that someone at some time might need the data being so carelessly disposed of.
A particular item might be wanted once in 1,000 years. To save it all just in case of such a need isn't cost-effective, even in science. You spoke of the primitive equations of gravitation, and say it is primitive because its discovery is lost in the mists of antiquity. Why should that be? Didn't you mathematicians and scientists save all data, all information, back and back to the misty primeval time when those equations were discovered?
Selden groaned and made no attempt to answer. He said, "Well, Hummon, so much for my idea. As we look back into the past and as society grows smaller, a useful psychohistory becomes more likely. But knowledge dwindles even more rapidly than size, so psychohistory becomes less likely, and the less outweighs the more."
To be sure, there is the mycogen sector, said Doris, musing.
Hummon looked up quickly.
So there is, and that would be the perfect place to put Selden. I should have thought of it myself.
Mycogen sector, repeated Harry, looking from one to the other. What and where is mycogen sector?
Harry, please, I'll tell you later. Right now, I have preparations to make. You'll leave tonight.
33. Doris had urged Selden to sleep a bit. They would be leaving halfway between lights out and lights on, under cover of night, while the rest of the university slept. She insisted he could still use a little rest.
"And have you sleep on the floor again?" Selden asked.
She shrugged.
"The bed will only hold one, and if we both try to crowd into it, neither of us will get much sleep."
He looked at her hungrily for a moment and said, "Then I'll sleep on the floor this time."
"No, you won't. I wasn't the one who lay in a coma in the sleet."
As it happened, neither slept. Though they darkened the room, and though the perpetual hum of Trantor was only a drowsy sound in the relatively quiet confines of the university, Selden found that he had to talk. He said,
"I've been so much trouble to you, Doris, here at the university. I've even been keeping you from your work. Still, I'm sorry I'll have to leave you."
Doris said,
"You won't leave me. I'm coming with you. Hummon is arranging a leave of absence for me."
Selden said, dismayed, "I can't ask you to do that."
"You're not. Hummon's asking it. I must guard you. After all, I failed in connection with Upperside, and should make up for it."
"I told you. Please don't feel guilty about that." "Still, I must admit I would feel more comfortable with you at my side. If I could only be sure I wasn't interfering with your life."
Doris said softly, "You're not, Harry. Please go to sleep."
Selden lay silent for a while, then whispered, "Are you sure Hummon can really arrange everything, Doris?"
Doris said, "He's a remarkable man. He's got influence here at the university and everywhere else, I think. If he says he can arrange for an indefinite leave for me, I'm sure he can. He is a most persuasive man."
"I know," said Selden. "Sometimes I wonder what he really wants of me."
"What he says," said Doris. "He's a man of strong and idealistic ideas and dreams. You sound as though you know him well, Doris.
Oh, yes, I know him well.
Intimately. Doris made an odd noise.
I'm not sure what you're implying, Harry, but assuming the most insolent interpretation, no, I don't know him intimately. What business would that be of yours, anyway?
I'm sorry, said Selden. I just didn't want inadvertently to be invading someone else's
property. That's even more insulting. I think you had better go to sleep.
I'm sorry again, Doris, but I can't sleep. Let me at least change the subject. You haven't explained what the Mycogen sector is. Why will it be good for me to go there? What's it like?
It's a small sector, with a population of only about 2 million, if I remember correctly. The thing is that the Mycogenians cling tightly to a set of traditions about early history, and are supposed to have very ancient records not available to anyone else.
It's just possible they would be of more use to you in your attempted examination of pre-imperial times than Orthodox historians might be.
All our talk about early history brought the sector to mind.
Have you ever seen their records?
No, I don't know anyone who has.
Can you be sure that the records really exist, then?
Actually, I can't say. The assumption among non-Mycogenians is that they're a bunch of madcaps, but that may be quite unfair. They certainly say they have records, so perhaps they do. In any case, we would be out of sight there. The Mycogenians keep strictly to themselves. And now, please do go to sleep.
And somehow, Selden finally did. 34. Harry Selden and Doris Van Abbeley left the university grounds at 0300. Selden realized that Doris had to be the leader. She knew Trantor better than he did, 2 years better. She was obviously a close friend of Hummin. How close? The question kept nagging at him, and she understood his instructions. Both she and Selden were swathed in light, swirling cloaks with tight-fitting hoods. The style had been a short-lived clothing fad at the university, and among young intellectuals generally, some years back. And though right now it might provoke laughter, it had the saving grace of covering them well and of making them unrecognizable, at least at a cursory glance. Hummin had said, "There's a possibility that the event upperside was completely innocent, and that there are no agents after you, Selden. But let's be prepared for the worst." Selden had asked anxiously, "Won't you come with us?"
"I would like to," said Hummin, "but I must limit my absence from work if I am not to become a target myself. You understand?"
Selden sighed. He understood. They entered an expressway car and found a seat as far as possible from the few who had already boarded. Selden wondered why anyone should be on the expressways at 3 in the morning, and then thought that it was lucky some were, or he and Doris would be entirely too conspicuous. Selden fell to watching the endless panorama that passed in review as the equally endless line of coaches moved along the endless monorail on an endless electromagnetic field. The expressway passed row upon row of dwelling units, few of them very tall, but some, for all he knew, very deep. Still, if tens of millions of square kilometers formed an urbanized total, even 40 billion people would not require very tall structures or very closely packed ones. They did pass open areas, in most of which crops seemed to be growing, but some of which were clearly park-like. And there were numerous structures whose nature he couldn't guess. Factories? Office buildings? Who knew? One large featureless cylinder struck him as though it might be a water tank. After all, Trantor had to have a fresh water supply.
Did they sluice rain from upperside, filter and treat it, then store it? It seemed inevitable that they should.
Selden did not have very long to study the view, however. Doris muttered, "This is about where we should be getting off."
She stood up, and her strong fingers gripped his arm. They were off the expressway now, standing on solid flooring, while Doris studied the directional signs. The signs were unobtrusive, and there were many of them. Selden's heart sank. Most of them were in pictographs and initials, which were undoubtedly understandable to native Trantorians, but which were alien to him.
"This way," said Doris.
"Which way? How do you know?"
"See that? Two wings and an arrow."
"Two wings? Oh." He had thought of it as an upside-down W, wide and shallow, but he could see where it might be the stylized wings of a bird. "Why don't they use words?" he said sullenly.
"Because words vary from world to world. What an air jet is here could be a soar on Cinna, or a swoop on other worlds. The two wings and an arrow are a galactic symbol for an air vessel, and the symbol is understood everywhere. Don't you use them on Helicon?"
"Not much. Helicon is a fairly homogeneous world, culturally speaking, and we tend to cling to our private ways firmly, because we're overshadowed by our neighbors."
"See," said Doris, "there's where your psychohistory might come in. You could show that even with different dialects, the use of set symbols galaxy-wide is a unifying force."
"That won't help." He was following her through empty, dim alleyways, and part of his mind wondered what the crime rate might be on Trantor, and whether this was a high-crime area. "You can have a billion rules, each covering a single phenomenon, and you can derive no generalizations from that. That's what one means when one says that a system might be interpreted only by a model as complex as itself. Doris, are we heading for an air jet?" She stopped and turned to look at him with an amused frown.
"If we're following the symbols for air jets, do you suppose we're trying to reach a golf course? Are you afraid of air jets in the way so many Trantorians are?"
"No, no. We fly freely on Helicon, and I make use of air jets frequently. It's just that when Hummond took me to the university, he avoided commercial air travel because he thought we would leave too clear a trail."
"That's because they knew where you were to begin with, Harry, and were after you already. Right now, it may be that they don't know where you are, and we're using an obscure port and a private air jet."
"And who'll be doing the flying?"
"A friend of Hummond's, I presume."
"Can he be trusted, do you suppose?"
"If he's a friend of Hummond's, he surely can."
"You certainly think highly of Hummond," said Selden, with a twinge of discontent.
"With reason," said Doris, with no attempt at coyness. "He's the best."
Selden's discontent did not dwindle.
"There's the air jet," she said.
It was a small one, with oddly shaped wings. Standing beside it was a small man, dressed in the usual glaring Trantorian colors. Doris said,
"We're Psycho."
The pilot said, "And I'm History." They followed him into the air jet, and Selden said, "Whose ideas were the passwords?"
"Hummond's,"
said Doris. Selden snorted. "Somehow, I didn't think Hummond would have a sense of humor. He's so solemn." Doris smiled. Sunmaster. Sunmaster 14, a leader of the Mycogen sector of ancient Trantor. As is true of all the leaders of this ingrown sector, little is known of him.
That he plays any role at all in history is due entirely to his interrelationship with Harry Seldon in the course of the flight. Encyclopedia Galactica. 35. There were just two seats behind the compact pilot compartment, and when Seldon sat down on padding that gave slowly beneath him, meshed fabric came forward to encircle his legs, waist, and chest, and a hood came down over his forehead and ears. He felt imprisoned, and when he turned to his left with difficulty, and only slightly, he could see that doors was similarly enclosed. The pilot took his own seat and checked the controls. Then he said, "I'm Endor Levanian, at your service. You're enmeshed because there will be a considerable acceleration at liftoff. Once we're in the open and flying, you'll be released. You needn't tell me your names. It's none of my business." He turned in his seat and smiled at them out of a gnome-like face that wrinkled as his lips spread outward. "Any psychological difficulties, youngsters?" Doris said lightly, "I'm an outworlder, and I'm used to flying." "That is also true for myself," said Seldon, with a bit of hauteur. "Excellent, youngsters. Of course, this isn't your ordinary airjet, and you may not have done any night flying, but I'll count on you to bear up." He was enmeshed, too, but Seldon could see that his arms were entirely free. A dull hum sounded inside the jet, growing in intensity and rising in pitch. Without actually becoming unpleasant, it threatened to do so, and Seldon made a gesture as though to shake his head and get the sound out of his ears, but the attempt to do so merely seemed to stiffen the hold of the head mesh. The jet then sprang, it was the only verb Seldon could find to describe the event, into the air, and he found himself pushed hard against the back and bottom of his seat. Through the windshield in front of the pilot, Seldon saw, with a twinge of horror, the flat rise of a wall, and then a round opening appear in that wall. It was similar to the hole into which the air taxi had plunged the day he and Hummann had left the Imperial sector, but though this one was large enough for the body of the jet, it certainly did not leave room for the wings. Seldon's head turned as far to the right as he could manage, and did so just in time to see the wing on his side wither and collapse. The jet plunged into the opening and was seized by the electromagnetic field and hurtled along a lighted tunnel. The acceleration was constant, and there were occasional clicking noises that Seldon imagined might be the passing of individual magnets. And then, in less than 10 minutes, the jet was spewed out into the atmosphere, headlong into the sudden, pervasive darkness of night. The jet decelerated as it passed beyond the electromagnetic field, and Seldon felt himself flung against the mesh and plastered there for a few breathless moments. Then the pressure ceased, and the mesh disappeared altogether. "How are you, youngsters?" came the cheerful voice of the pilot. "I'm not sure," said Seldon. He turned to Doris. "Are you all right?"
"Certainly," she answered. "I think Mr. Levanian was putting us through his paces to see if we were really outworlders. Is that so, Mr. Levanian?"
"Some people like excitement," said Levanian. "Do you?"
"Within limits," said Doris.
Then Seldon added approvingly, "as any reasonable person would admit." Seldon went on, "It might have seemed less humorous to you, sir, if you had ripped the wings off the jet."
"Impossible, sir. I told you this is not your ordinary air jet. The wings are thoroughly computerized. They change their length, width, curvature, and overall shape to match the speed of the jet, the speed and direction of the wind, the temperature, and half a dozen other variables. The wings wouldn't tear off unless the jet itself was subjected to stresses that would splinter it."
There was a spatter against Selden's window. He said, "It's raining."
"It often is," said the pilot.
Selden peered out the window. On Helicon or on any other world, there would have been lights visible, the illuminated works of man. Only on Trantor would it be dark. Well, not entirely. At one point he saw the flash of a beacon light. Perhaps the higher reaches of Upperside had warning lights. As usual, Doris took note of Selden's uneasiness. Patting his hand, she said,
"I'm sure the pilot knows what he's doing, Harry."
"I'll try to be sure of it too, Doris, but I wish he'd share some of that knowledge with us," Selden said in a voice loud enough to be overheard.
"I don't mind sharing," said the pilot. "To begin with, we're heading up, and we'll be above the cloud deck in a few minutes. Then there won't be any rain, and we'll even see the stars."
He had timed the remark beautifully, for a few stars began to glitter through the feathery cloud remnants, and then all the rest sprang into brightness as the pilot flicked off the lights inside the cabin. Only the dim illumination of his own instrument panel remained to compete, and outside the window the sky sparkled brightly. Doris said,
"That's the first time in over 2 years that I've seen the stars. Aren't they marvelous? They're so bright, and there are so many of them."
The pilot said, "Trantor is nearer the center of the galaxy than most of the outer worlds." Since Helicon was in a sparse corner of the galaxy, and its starfield was dim and unimpressive, Selden found himself speechless. Doris said,
"How quiet this flight has become."
"So it is," said Selden. "What powers the jet, Mr. Levanian?"
"A microfusion motor and a thin stream of hot gas."
"I didn't know we had working microfusion air jets. They talk about it, but..."
"There are a few small ones like this. So far they exist only on Trantor and are used entirely by high government officials."
Selden said, "The fees for such travel must come high."
"Very high, sir."
"How much is Mr. Hummond being charged, then?"
"There's no charge for this flight. Mr. Hummond is a good friend of the company who owns these jets."
Selden grunted. Then he asked, "Why aren't there more of these microfusion air jets?"
"Too expensive, for one thing, sir. Those that exist fulfill all the demand."
"You could create more demand with larger jets."
"Maybe so, but the company has never managed to make microfusion engines strong enough for large air jets."
Selden thought of Hummond's complaint that technological innovation had declined to a low level. "Decadent," he murmured.
"What?"
said Doris.
"Nothing," said Selden. "I was just thinking of something Hummond once said to me."
He looked out at the stars and said, "Are we moving westward, Mr. Levanian?"
"Yes, we are. How did you know?"
"Because I thought that we would see the dawn by now if we were heading east to meet it." But dawn, pursuing the planet, finally caught up with them, and sunlight, real sunlight, brightened the cabin walls. It didn't last long, however, for the jet curved downward and into the clouds. Blue and gold vanished and were replaced by dingy gray, and both Selden and Doris emitted disappointed cries at being deprived of even a few more moments of true sunlight. When they sank beneath the clouds, Upperside was immediately below them, and its surface, at least at this spot, was a rolling mixture of wooded grottos and intervening grassland. It was the sort of thing Clausia had told Selden existed on Upperside. Again, there was little time for observation, however. An opening appeared below them, rimmed by lettering that spelled Mycogen. They plunged in. 36. They landed at a jetport that seemed deserted to Selden's wondering eyes. The pilot, having completed his task, shook hands with both Harry and Doris and took his jet up into the air with a rush, plunging it into an opening that appeared for his benefit. There seemed then nothing to do but wait. There were benches that could seat perhaps 100 people, but Selden and Doris Van Abbley were the only two people around. The port was rectangular, surrounded by walls in which there must be many tunnels that could open to receive or deliver jets. But there were no jets present after their own had departed, and none arrived while they waited. There were no people arriving, or any indications of habitation. The very life hum of Trantor was muted. Selden felt this aloneness to be oppressive. He turned to Doris and said, "What is it that we must do here? Have you any idea?" Doris shook her head.
"Hammond told me we would be met by Sun Master 14. I don't know anything beyond that."
Sun Master 14. What would that be?
A human being, I presume. From the name, I can't be certain whether it would be a man or a woman.
An odd name. Oddity is in the mind of the receiver. I am sometimes taken to be a man by those who have never met me. What fools they must be, said Selden, smiling.
Not at all. Judging from my name, they are justified. I'm told it is a popular masculine name on various worlds.
I've never encountered it before.
That's because you aren't much of a galactic traveler. The name Harry is common enough everywhere, although I once knew a woman named Harry, pronounced like your name but spelled with an E. In Mycogen, as I recall, particular names are confined to families and numbered.
But Sunmaster seems so unrestrained a name.
What's a little braggadocio? Back on Cinna, Doors is from an old local expression meaning spring gift.
Because you were born in the spring?
No, I first saw the light of day at the height of Cinna's summer. But the name struck my people as pleasant, regardless of its traditional and largely forgotten meaning.
In that case, perhaps Sunmaster. And a deep, severe voice said, "That is my name, tribesman." Selden, startled, looked to his left. An open ground car had somehow drawn close. It was boxy and archaic, looking almost like a delivery wagon. In it, at the controls, was a tall old man who looked vigorous despite his age. With stately majesty, he got out of the ground car. He wore a long white gown with voluminous sleeves pinched in at the wrists. Beneath the gown were soft sandals from which the big toe protruded, while his head, beautifully shaped, was completely hairless. He regarded the two calmly with his deep blue eyes. He said,
"I greet you, tribesmen."
Selden said with automatic politeness, "Greetings, sir." Then, honestly puzzled, he asked, "How did you get in?"
"Through the entrance, which closed behind me. You paid little heed."
"I suppose we didn't. But then we didn't know what to expect. Nor do we now."
"Tribesman Chetter Hummin informed the brethren that there would be members from two of the tribes arriving. He asked that you be cared for."
"Then you know Hummin?"
"We do. He has been of service to us. And because he, a worthy tribesman, has been of service to us, so must we be now to him. There are few who come to Mycogen, and few who leave. I am to make you secure, give you house room, see that you are undisturbed. You will be safe here."
Doris bent her head. "We are grateful, Sunmaster 14.
Sunmaster turned to look at her with an air of dispassionate contempt.
I am not unaware of the customs of the tribes, he said. I know that among them a woman may well speak before being spoken to. I am therefore not offended. I would ask her to have a care among others of the brethren who may be of lesser knowledge in the matter.
Oh, really? Said Doris, who was clearly offended, even if Sunmaster was not.
In truth, agreed Sunmaster. Nor is it needful to use my numerical identifier when I alone of my cohort am with you. Sunmaster will be sufficient. Now, I will ask you to come with me so that we may leave this place, which is of too tribal a nature to comfort me.
Comfort is for all of us, said Selden, perhaps a little more loudly than was necessary. And we will not budge from this place unless we are assured that we will not be forcibly bent to your liking against our own natures. It is our custom that a woman may speak whenever she has something to say. If you have agreed to keep us secure, that security must be psychological as well as physical.
Sunmaster gazed at Selden levelly and said, You are bold, young tribesman. Your name?
I am Harry Selden of Helicon. My companion is Doris Benevoli of Cinna.
Sunmaster bowed slightly as Selden pronounced his own name, did not move at the mention of Doris' name. He said, I have sworn to tribesman Hummin that we will keep you safe, so I will do what I can to protect your woman companion in this. If she wishes to exercise her impudence, I will do my best to see that she is held guiltless. Yet in one respect you must conform.
And he pointed with infinite scorn, first to Selden's head and then to Doris.
What do you mean? Said Selden.
Your cephalic hair.
What about it?
It must not be seen.
Do you mean we're to shave our heads like you? Certainly not.
My head is not shaven, tribesman Selden. I was depilated when I entered puberty, as are all the brethren and their women.
If we're talking about depilation, then more than ever the answer is no. Never.
Tribesmen, we ask neither shaving nor depilation. We ask only that your hair be covered when you are among us.
How?
I have brought skin caps that will mold themselves to your skulls, together with strips that will hide the superoptical patches, the eyebrows. You will wear them while with us. And, of course, tribesman Selden, you will shave daily, or oftener if that becomes necessary.
But why must we do this?
Because, to us, hair on the head is repulsive and obscene.
Surely you and all your people know that it is customary for others, in all the worlds of the galaxy, to retain their cephalic.